Chapter 18. Considerable bitterness when reflecting that at the Battle of Actium, which was fought for no less a stake than the dominion of the world, the fleet of Octavianus Caesar and the fleet of Antonius, including the Egyptian division and Cleopatra's galley with purple sails, probably cost less than two modern battleships, or, as the modern naval book jargon has it, two capital units. But no amount of lubberly book jargon can disguise a fact well calculated to afflict the soul of every sound economist. It is not likely that the Mediterranean will ever behold a battle with a greater issue, but when the time comes for another historical fight, its bottom will be enriched as never before by a quantity of jagged scrap iron, paid for at pretty nearly its weight of gold by the deluded populations inhabiting the isles and continents of this planet. Happy he who, like Ulysses, has made an adventurous voyage, and there is no such sea for adventurous voyages as the Mediterranean, the inland sea which the ancients looked upon as so vast, and so full of wonders. And, indeed, it was terrible and wonderful, for it is we alone who, swayed by the audacity of our minds, and the tremors of our hearts, are the sole artisans of all the wonder and romance of the world. It was for the Mediterranean sailors that fair-haired sirens sang among the black rocks seething in white foam, and mysterious voices spoke in the darkness above the moving wave, voices menacing, seductive, or prophetic, like that voice heard at the beginning of the Christian era by the master of an African vessel in the Gulf of Cirta, whose calm nights are full of strange murmurs and flitting shadows. It called him by name, bidding him go and tell all men that the great god Pan was dead. But the great legend of the Mediterranean, the legend of traditional song and grave history, lives, fascinating and immortal, in our minds. The dark and fearful sea of the subtle Ulysses's wanderings, agitated by the wrath of Olympian gods, harboring on its isles the fury of strange monsters, and the wiles of strange women, the highway of heroes and sages, of warriors, pirates, and saints, the workaday sea of Carthaginian merchants, and the pleasure lake of the Roman Caesars, claims the veneration of every seaman as the historical home of that spirit of open defiance against the great waters of the earth which is the very soul of his calling. Issuing thence to the west and south, as a youth leaves the shelter of his parental house, this spirit found the way to the Indies, discovered the coasts of a new continent, and traversed at last the immensity of the great Pacific, rich in groups of islands remote and mysterious like the constellations of the sky. The first impulse of navigation took its visible form in that tideless basin freed from hidden shoals and treacherous currents, as if in tender regard for the infancy of the art. The steep shores of the Mediterranean favored the beginners in one of humanity's most daring enterprises, and the enchanting inland sea of classic adventure has led mankind gently from headland to headland, from bay to bay, from island to island, out into the promise of worldwide oceans beyond the Pillars of Hercules. XXXIX. The charm of the Mediterranean dwells in the unforgettable flavor of my early days, and to this hour the sea, upon which the Romans alone ruled without dispute, has kept for me the fascination of youthful romance. The very first Christmas night I ever spent away from L, and was employed in running before a Gulf of Lions gale, which made the old ship groan in every timber as she skipped before it over the short seas until we brought her to, battered and out of breath, under the lee of Majorca, where the smooth water was torn by fierce cat's paws under a very stormy sky. We, or, rather, they, for I had hardly had two glimpses of salt water in my life till then, kept her standing off and on all that day, while I listened for the first time with the curiosity of my tender years to the song of the wind in a ship's rigging. The monotonous and vibrating note was destined to grow into the intimacy of the heart, pass into blood and bone, accompany the thoughts and acts of two full decades, remain to haunt like a reproach the peace of the quiet fireside, and enter into the very texture of respectable dreams, dreamed safely under a roof of rafters and tiles. The wind was fair, but that day we ran no more. The thing I will not call her a ship twice in the same half hour leaked. She leaked fully, generously, overflowingly, all over like a basket. I took an enthusiastic part in the excitement caused by that last infirmity of noble ships, without concerning myself much with the why or the wherefore. The surmise of my mature years is that, bored by her interminable life, the venerable antiquity was simply yawning with ennui at every seam. But at the time I did not know, I knew generally very little, and least of all, what I was doing in that galley. I remember that, exactly as in the comedy of Molière, my uncle asked the precise question in the very words, not of my confidential valet, however, but across great distances of land, in a letter whose mocking, but indulgent turn ill concealed his almost paternal anxiety. I fancy I tried to convey to him my utterly unfounded impression that the West Indies awaited my coming. I had to go there. It was a sort of mystic conviction, something in the nature of a call. But it was difficult to state intelligibly the grounds of this belief to that man of rigorous logic, if of infinite charity. The truth must have been that, all unversed in the arts of the wily Greek, the deceiver of gods, the lover of strange women, the evoker of bloodthirsty shades, I yet longed for the beginning of my own obscure odyssey, which, as was proper for a modern, should unroll its wonders and terrors beyond the pillars of Hercules. The disdainful ocean did not open wide to swallow up my audacity, though the ship, the ridiculous and ancient galley of my folly, the old, weary, disenchanted sugar wagon, seemed extremely disposed to open out and swallow up as much salt water as she could hold. This, if less grandiose, would have been as final a catastrophe. But no catastrophe occurred. I lived to watch on a strange shore a black and youthful Nausicaa, with a joyous train of attendant maidens, carrying baskets of linen to a clear stream overhung by the heads of slender palm trees. The vivid colors of their draped raiment, and the gold of their earrings invested with a barbaric and regal magnificence their figures, stepping out freely in a shower of broken sunshine. The whiteness of their teeth was still more dazzling than the splendor of jewels at their ears. The shaded side of the ravine gleamed with their smiles. They were as unabashed as so many princesses, but, alas, not one of them was the daughter of a jet-black sovereign. Such was my abominable luck in being born by the mere hair's breadth of 25 centuries too late into a world where kings have been growing scarce with scandalous rapidity, while the few who remain have adopted the uninteresting manners and customs of simple millionaires. Obviously it was a vain hope in 187 to see the ladies of a royal household walk in checkered sunshine, with baskets of linen on their heads, to the banks of a clear stream overhung by the starry fronds of palm trees. It was a vain hope. If I did not ask myself whether, limited by such discouraging impossibilities, life were still worth living, it was only because I had then before me several other pressing questions, some of which have remained unanswered to this day. The resonant, laughing voices of these gorgeous maidens scared away the multitude of hummingbirds, whose delicate wings wreathed with the mist of their vibration the tops of flowering bushes. No, they were not princesses. Their unrestrained laughter filling the hot, fern-clad ravine had a soulless limpidity, as of wild, inhuman dwellers in tropical woodlands. Following the example of certain prudent travelers, I withdrew unseen and returned, not much wiser, to the Mediterranean, the sea of classic adventures. XL. It was written that there, in the nursery of our navigating ancestors, I should learn to walk in the ways of my craft, and grow in the love of the sea, blind as young love often is, but absorbing and disinterested as all true love must be. I demanded nothing from it, not even adventure. In this I showed, perhaps, more intuitive wisdom than high self-denial. No adventure ever came to one for the asking. He who starts on a deliberate quest of adventure goes forth, but to gather dead sea fruit, unless, indeed, he he be beloved of the gods and great amongst heroes, like that most excellent cavalier Don Quixote de la Mancha. By us ordinary mortals of a mediocre animus, that is only too anxious, to pass by wicked giants for, so many honest windmills, adventures are entertained like visiting angels. They come upon our complacency unawares. As unbidden guests are apt to do, they often come at inconvenient times. And we are glad to let them go unrecognized, without any acknowledgement of so high a favor. After many years, on looking back from the middle turn of life's way at the events of the past, which, like a friendly crowd, seem to gaze sadly after us hastening towards the Cimmerian shore, we may see here and there, in the gray throng, some figure glowing with a faint radiance, as though it had caught all the light of our already crepuscular sky. And by this glow we may recognize the faces of our true adventures, of the once unbidden guests entertained unawares in our young days. If the Mediterranean, the venerable and sometimes atrociously ill-tempered nurse of all navigators, was to rock my youth, the providing of the cradle necessary for that operation was entrusted by fate to the most casual assemblage of irresponsible young men, all, however, older than myself, that, as if drunk with provincial sunshine, frittered life away in joyous levity on the model of Balzac's Ister de Triais, qualified by a dash of romance de K-B-D-P. She who was my cradle in those years had been built on the river of Savona by a famous builder of boats, was rigged in Corsica by another good man, and was described on her papers as a tartan of 60 tons. In reality, she was a true balancel, with two short masts raking forward, and two curved yards, each as long as her hull, a true child of the Latin lake, with a spread of two enormous sails resembling the pointed wings on a seabird's slender body, and herself, like a bird indeed, skimming rather than sailing the seas. Her name was the Tremolino. How is this to be translated? The Quiverer? What a name to give the pluckiest little craft that ever dipped her sights in angry foam. I had felt her, it is true, trembling for nights and days together under my feet, but it was with the high-strung tenseness of her faithful courage. In her short, but brilliant, career she has taught me nothing, but she has given me everything. I owe to her the awakened love for the sea that, with the quivering of her swift little body, and the humming of the wind under the foot of her lateen sails, stole into my heart with a sort of gentle violence, and brought my imagination under its despotic sway. The Tremolino. To this day I cannot utter, or even write that name without a strange tightening of the breast, and the gasp of mingled delight and dread of one's first passionate experience. XLI. We four formed, to use a term well understood nowadays in every social sphere, a syndicate owning the Tremolino. An international and astonishing syndicate. And we were all ardent royalists of the snow-white legitimist complexion, heaven only knows why. In all associations of men there is generally one who, by the authority of age, and of a more experienced wisdom, imparts a collective character to the whole set. If I mention that the oldest of us was very old, extremely old, nearly 30 years old, and that he used to declare with gallant carelessness, "I live by my sword," I think I have given enough information on the score of our collective wisdom. He was a North Carolinian gentleman, J. MKB were the initials of his name, and he really did live by the sword, as far as I know. He died by it too, later on, in a Balkanian squabble, in the cause of some Serbs or else Bulgarians, who were neither Catholics nor gentlemen at least, not in the exalted, but narrow sense he attached to that last word. Poor J.M. K.B., American. Catholic, agent Ilham, as he was disposed to describe himself in moments of lofty expansion. Are there still to be found in Europe gentlemen keen of face and elegantly slight of body, of distinguished aspect, with a fascinating drawing-room manner, and with a dark, fatal glance, who live by their swords, I wonder? His family had been ruined in the Civil War, I fancy, and seems for a decade or so to have led a wandering life in the old world. As to Henry C., the next in age and wisdom of our band, he had broken loose from the unyielding rigidity of his family, solidly rooted, if I remember rightly, in a well-to-do London suburb. On their respectable authority he introduced himself meekly to strangers as a black sheep. I have never seen a more guileless specimen of an outcast. Never. However, his people had the grace to send him a little money now and then. Enamored of the South, of Provence, of its people, its life, its sunshine and its poetry, narrow-chested, tall and short-sighted, he strode along the streets and the lanes, his long feet projecting far in advance of his body, and his white nose and gingery mustache buried in an open book. For he had the habit of reading as he walked. How he avoided falling into precipices, off the quays, or down staircases, is a great mystery. The sides of his overcoat bulged out with pocket editions of various poets. When not engaged in reading Virgil, Homer, or Mistral, in parks, restaurants, streets, and such like public places, he indited sonnets in French to the eyes, ears, chin, hair, and other visible perfections of a nymph called Therese, the daughter, honesty compels me to state, of a certain Madame Leonor who kept a small café for sailors in one of the narrowest streets of the old town. No more charming face, clear-cut like an antique gem, and delicate in coloring like the petal of a flower, had ever been set on, alas, a somewhat squat body. He read his verses aloud to her in the very café with the innocence of a little child, and the vanity of a poet. We followed him there willingly enough, if only to watch the divine Therese laugh, under the vigilant black eyes of Madame Leonor, her mother. She laughed very prettily, not so much at the sonnets, which she could not but esteem, as at poor Henry's French accent, which was unique, resembling the warbling of birds, if birds ever warbled with a stuttering, nasal intonation. Our third partner was Roger P. de la S., the most Scandinavian-looking of provincial squires, fair, and 6 feet high, as became a descendant of sea-roving Northmen, authoritative, incisive, wittily scornful, with a comedy in three acts in his pocket, and in his breast a heart lighted by a hopeless passion for his beautiful cousin, married to a wealthy hide and tallow merchant. He used to take us to lunch at their house without ceremony. I admired the good lady's sweet patience. The husband was a conciliatory soul, with a great fund of resignation, which he expended on Oger's friends. I suspect he was secretly horrified at these invasions. But it was a Carlist salon, and as such we were made welcome. The possibility of raising Catalonia in the interest of the Rey Neto, who had just then crossed the Pyrenees, was much discussed there. Don Carlos, no doubt, must have had many queer friends. It is the common lot of all pretenders, but amongst them none more extravagantly fantastic than the Tremolino Syndicate, which used to... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.